Good morning, Eugenia.
Good morning to you.
I'm delighted and honored to have you here. Thank you for being available to be interviewed for the Tuesday afternoon show.
It's a pleasure.
So I want to start with some personal history. You were born in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Please tell us a little bit about your childhood, siblings, family relationships.
Well, we were in Cambridge because my father, during World War II, and at a very young age, was able to figure out for, I guess, the Army-Navy, it must have been Navy, how to make the sonar read the entire circle.
Oh, my.
So he was sent to Washington, and then they sent him to Harvard to do more research. And that's why I was a Harvard baby. And we lived there and in Massachusetts for a while, and then moved after my father left Harvard, etc. We moved to West Hartford, Connecticut, and I grew up there in different parts of West Hartford, Connecticut. I think I had was very lucky to be part of that school system. It was all public school. Mm-hmm. And I went to William Henry Hall High School. Yay, rah-rah, class of, I'm not telling. and then I went on to Barnard College.
Right.
And halfway through...
So before we get to college, yes. I want to find out about, do you have siblings?
Yes, indeed. I have my big sister, Dr. Julie Engelfinger,
right.
who is a very famous doctor at Harvard. She's number two at New England Journal,
right.
and she's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an amazing younger sister who is 10 years younger than I am.
Mm.
And she was born in West Hartford.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very good and tight
mm-hmm.
and a happy family.
So three daughters, three sisters.
Three sisters.
So years ago, I read an article in the New Yorker that basically was stating, or making the claim, that one's relationship to one's siblings equals or tops one's relationship to one's parents in terms of your emotional development, your emotional makeup. How do you respond to that? You're very close to your sisters. Do you think
I respond to it by saying I believe that's absolutely true. You know, I don't want to go into real personal stuff,
sure.
but I think I got more from my sisters
mm-hmm.
than from my parents. They were, they had a lot of things on their minds and
mm-hmm.
and certain problems. And, you know, the three of us could hang out together, especially my older sister, because
mm-hmm.
there was this gap between us and the younger sister. But when the younger sister came, I was 10 years old, which is the perfect age to be to pretend to be mommy.
Mm-hmm.
And I adored her and still do. And with my big sister, I always deferred to her, and she's my go-to person
mm-hmm.
still. So
yeah.
I would say they're best friends, and they are great advisors, and the three of us are still in awe of our mother, who turned 103 this April 14th.
Wow.
And she's the Energizer Bunny. She just keeps on going.
How exciting.
Yeah.
How nice for you.
Amazing.
So when did you find the flute? How old were you?
I was 10 years old.
And was it your first instrument?
No, I played the piano. We all played the piano. My parents were very musical.
Mm-hmm.
My mother
mm.
was a dancer
mm.
and a mathematician. First woman accepted into City College School of Engineering and didn't get a degree because they moved to somewhere else. And so...
Were you aware of that at the time, that she was a kind of a trailblazer?
Not at all.
Ah.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
But I knew she was a wonderful dancer, and she's
mm-hmm.
a painter and a potter, and she's done many, many
mm.
things. And my father's an inventor, was an inventor. He invented more than he had more than 600 worldwide patents, and he was brilliant and somewhat remote, but they were musical. My father had sung with David Randolph's choir in New York, and my mother was very musical. They both played the piano, so we had to play the piano first. And then I had one of those moments at school.
When you were 10 years old?
When I was, how old was I? I guess I was 10 years old.
Okay.
Let's say I was. Beach Park School in West Hartford, Connecticut. A group of musicians from the Hartford Symphony came and demonstrated their instruments,
mm-hmm.
and I heard the flute, And I was literally enchanted, and I ran home and I said, I have to play the flute. And luckily in those days at a public school, you could get a teacher, an instrument, and that's how I started out. And I just wish we could do that in every public school in America. And I think there is a lot being done to make that happen. I know the New York Philharmonic is doing that in New York, and it's making a difference. So
it seems as the school budgets are cut, there are organizations and individuals in communities that are stepping up,
exactly.
Especially in major orchestras, are really trying to support and encourage the studying of music.
Right, because it's not even if these kids become musicians, they may become audience members, which we desperately need.
Yes, well, it informs your worldview in so many ways. It broadens life, so it's so valuable.
Regardless
of what you end up doing. So you did go to Barnard, English major.
Yes, indeed.
And then let's talk about that. So what did you have a fondness for a specific kind of literature?
Oh, yes, indeed. I was a poet at that point, and that's what I thought I was, and a flute player. And after 2 years at Barnard, my flute teacher, Julius Baker, first flute of the New York Philharmonic, said to me, you know, you've got the stuff of being a really great flute player, but you've got to come to Juilliard.
And
that's where he was. And he said, I have a game plan for you, because he knew I was a writer as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you come to Juilliard, and you get into a great orchestra, and then you write the All-American novel.
And, Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah. I went to my parents, and I said, I would like to do this. You know, in those days, going to Juilliard cost about $1,100 a year, or something ridiculous. You know, now it's $100,000 a year. So I went to Juilliard. I switched to Juilliard. And what a crazy difference it was, because at Barnard, which is connected to Columbia, everybody's sort of walking around thinking, oh, this year I think maybe I'll do science. Next year maybe I'll do mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to Juilliard, and it's like everyone is 25 years older than they should be, because it's not that they just want to play an instrument. They want to be the best in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very formative for me, because my father always said to me, when everybody said to me, you can't write a novel, you can't play the flute, you can't do all these things, and he would always say,
in other words, you can't do them all collectively, you can't do them individually.
You can't do all those things. That's what everybody was saying to me.
That's
you have
the message
to just,
you got
you know,
from
my
the
message was, either you're going to write, either you're going to play the flute, or blah, blah. I was also acting, don't ask.
Oh, I can see that.
And my father said, you can do whatever you want to do as long as you apply your ass to the chair. And what he meant was do the work.
Do the work.
And I think I learned how to do that. And that has been what I passed on to my daughters, who are also very accomplished. Mm-hmm. And
you have one daughter who's an opera singer and one who's a
singer-songwriter, painter, etc.
Right.
Yeah. And they're both teachers, and they both do a million things because they apply their ass to the chair.
So at this point, you're in your early 20s?
Are you asking currently?
No. At this point, you go to Juilliard, you're studying music.
Right.
You still want to have poetic, you know, activities.
Right.
So what I'm curious about is, at that point in your life, what were you afraid of? What scared you? And then how did you address those fears and work through them?
Ah, that's a very interesting question. I was not fearful then. I am fearful now.
Mm.
But then I was not fearful. I auditioned for first flute in the Denver, then called Denver Symphony, and Vladimir Golshman was the conductor, and he said, it's yours. But I had a boyfriend whose name was Pinchas Zukerman. He was 3 years younger than I was. He was like 18 or something. And he said, don't do that, marry me. I thought, what? And I did. And he was fabulous and had a brilliant, and has a brilliant career. And, I went with him around the world as he played. And I did have an epiphany, I remember, in Rotterdam, when everyone was standing up and screaming after he played Tchaikovsky Concerto. And I realized, wait a minute, you're acting as if this is for you too. It's not. You have to do your own thing. Mm-hmm. And Pinky, as I called him, was very accepting and very happy to see that I really wanted to do my own thing. And I won the Young Concert Artist competition, I guess when I was about 22 or 23, and got my town hall debut. And it was very nicely received. Mm-hmm. And then Saul Hirok took me onto his roster. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and at the same time, I started writing. And my first novel came out when I was, it's called...
this is Deceptive Cadence?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Deceptive Cadence. And that was when I was also quite young, but I was lucky. I got really nice reviews and a wonderful quote from Leonard Bernstein, which was really nice.
That must have meant a lot to you.
Oh, yeah. He meant a lot to me. Yeah. He was someone who had people at his house all the time, and he loved Pinky and Itzhak and all the young kids, so we hung out.
I'm sure he was energized. I'm sure it was a two-way street. He must have been energized.
Well, it energizes me now to be someone who is playing with kids who are 30 years younger than I am.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. How exciting.
Yeah, it is.
So I'm getting a sense that you were confident in your talent. You didn't. I'm not getting any sense of worrying about, am I good enough? Can I do this? You seem very comfortable with your talent and your skill.
You're so wrong.
Oh, really? Okay, good. Correct me. So
no, I was always worrying and hoping, and I think, you know, I was never brash, etc. Mm-hmm. I also had that feeling that I better really play well because people are going to say it's only because she's married to Pinka Zukerman.
Ah.
And one of the funniest things that I remember was giving a recital, and just as I took my first breath and was about to blow into the flute, two little old ladies in the front row, one leaned to the other and said, "Eugenia Zukerman, I know her. She used to be married to Itzhak Perlman." And I thought, you know, you gotta laugh. And I don't know, it sort of helped me ease up because I thought people don't know. But I really felt I worked hard and I tried to play my best.
I'm curious about the interplay between what I would call being intuitive as a musician and as an artist versus the incredible discipline that playing an instrument requires. How do you balance and honor the two aspects of being an artist and a musician? Intuition versus just sheer do the work.
I think there's intuition in getting the work too, because learning the notes, playing the notes, etc. There's a way in which playing the flute for me has always been a real way to express my personal emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's probably true for many artists, many, many musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Because, on the page, in fact, the page, you do follow those notes, but there's so much in between the notes, and there's so many ways in which you can play any note.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's wonderful to have a great teacher, as I did in Julius Baker, but I think I learned more from Pinky than I did from anyone else, just by listening to what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And a violin really sings, especially with a great player. And I think I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot also by being part of this sort of Stern gang, they used to call them. You know, Itzhak Perlman and Pinky and, so many of those. And Jacqueline Dupre was my very close friend, and we traveled together because Pinky and Daniel and Jackie had a trio. And, I got to hear the best of the best. And I also got to see how, you know, if you have ever seen any of the videos of them playing, they're all laughing beforehand, etc. But they get out there, and it's a different
thing. Very focused.
Yeah.
Very focused.
It's almost like dual personalities. But I think all of those people that I knew then who are still on the planet are still playing incredibly well.
So how did having two daughters inform your work as a musician and writer?
Having two daughters was the best thing that ever happened to me, more so than my many marriages. You know, it was somehow I took to it very easily, and I was so passionate about these children. They were so bright and lovely and easy, and I wanted them to enjoy music, which they did, and they're both musicians, as well as other things. But I think it made me put things in perspective in terms of what is most important. And I think it's very difficult, more so now for young couples, to come musicians, to have a child and keep going. It's in those days it was possible for us to travel with a nanny. And that's out of the question for most people in today's world. So I think that it grounded me.
So you've been playing and performing to great acclaim for decades. I'm curious if there's one composer that has continued to excite and challenge you. And if so, who is it and why?
There isn't one. All I can say is that there are many. And I'm now very excited about playing contemporary music, which I'm not great at. I will say that. You know, the kids are so much better at it than I am. But I am involved and interested in it. Also, because I've done a lot of administrative work, I was the artistic director of the Vail Valley Music Festival in Vail, Colorado for 13 years, and I was instrumental in bringing the New York Philharmonic, the Dallas Symphony, and the third one, Dallas and Philadelphia. How could I forget that? And that was enormously important for me because I learned how difficult it is and what a huge thing an orchestra is, what a huge thing it is to present music and make everyone happy or try to. And I think that helped me understand the underworking of the world of music.
Why aren't there more women conductors?
There are more and more, and that's exciting. I think there aren't more women conductors for the same reason there aren't more women in Congress. It's a guy's world. It was a guy's world, and that is changing, and we're making it change. And it's slow, and it's... But I also think that because that has opened up for women, people are understanding that it's a good thing. I have found a little bit of pushback from women in orchestras who will say they prefer to have a male conductor. And a lot of it, you know, women are not always so nice to women. And when you are a woman in an orchestra and there's a man who is up there, he is a, you know, a father figure, a lover figure, everything. You can feel that connection as a woman, but woman to woman, that's a different thing. So I find it very interesting, and I think it remains to be seen, you know, what's going to happen. I am looking forward to the day when the New York Philharmonic has a woman conductor, and they are so, I'm so excited about Jaap van Zweden taking over the New York Philharmonic because I met him in Vail, and he is a powerhouse, and the New York Philharmonic is a great orchestra.
Do you have any desire to conduct?
Gosh, no. No. I would not be able to, no.
Okay, so in addition to learning and performing new works and traveling around the world, you have been, or I guess you still are, the music correspondent for CBS News Sunday morning?
No, I was the artistic person for CBS Sunday morning for almost 30 years. And I was it was the luckiest thing of my life in a way. I got a phone call from someone who said he was Shad Northfield and he had a job for me and I was going to do it and I was going to love it. And I said, who the hell are you? I hadn't seen this program. It was 1 year old. And I said, I can't. I have a husband. I have children. I have a career. He said, you're going to do it. You're going to love it. And I owe a lot to Shad Northfield because I was able to interview for CBS television,
I think over 350 people.
Yes,
right? The artists
and the greatest artists of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, they decided, I won't say who the they are, but they didn't want any more high arts.
Mm.
So you have not seen classical music on CBS Sunday Morning
mm-hmm.
since.
Mm-hmm.
And that is makes me very sad, because people would come to me and say, I didn't know a violin could sound like that, or I didn't know a piano was made like
mm-hmm.
that. And that's a shame.
It is. So you did the CBS News Sunday Morning program.
Mm-hmm.
You've written two novels, Deceptive Cadence
yeah.
and Taking the Heat.
Mm-hmm.
Edited and contributed to an anthology of essays entitled In My Mother's Closet. You've also co-authored...
I wrote it, but anyhow.
Oh, you wrote the thing. Okay, good. Yeah. No, correct me. That's good. co-authored a nonfiction work, Coping with Prednisone, which addressed the side effects of a medication you took 95-96.
Yeah.
Since 1998, you've been the artistic director of Bravo, the Vail Valley Music Festival, and have now become the Artistic Director of Classics on Hudson, which is a volunteer position. You have three upcoming performances there. What I'm curious about, how do you sustain the intensity and energy to accomplish all these wonderful things?
Well, I don't think of it that way, and you did leave out one very important thing, and that is that for the past 2 years, I have been the artistic director of the Leaf Peeper Concerts, which is the oldest chamber music series in Columbia County. It's more than 55 years old, and it was started by Newell Jenkins, who was a great musicologist and brought back from Italy some of the greatest manuscripts that are that we have. And I was asked 2 years ago if I would think of taking over Classics on Hudson, and initially I didn't think I could do it, but Classics on Hudson is at the Hudson Opera House, and the people there are fabulous. And when I said I can do Leaf Peepers, it's called Leaf Peepers because of the fall foliage, which is gorgeous up here,
mm-hmm.
and people come to see it, as long as I could do Classics on Hudson in the spring. So that's why I feel I can do both. And I am crazy to do it.
Well, they're lucky to have you. I know Tammy's thrilled,
well,
you know, that
great.
Collaborative
they
process.
They are great. They are great.
So let's talk about the concerts coming up.
Yes, please.
So April 30th, John Deke.
John Deke is an extraordinary double bass player. He was second double bass in the New York Philharmonic for a very long time.
Mm.
And he has become the person who has an organization which is, I forget his exact name, for it's very young composers, that's what they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And on April 30th, we are doing a concert at the Opera House called Serious Fun with very young composers. And this program was developed by Mr. Deke to answer the question, what is children's music?
Mm.
This is now a wonderful worldwide program that promotes the innate creativity of children and gives them a sense of empowerment and inspires them to tap into their own creative spirits, which they may not even know they have.
And as per what we were talking about earlier, they can apply to many different fields as they evolve as people.
That is absolutely
yes.
true.
Right.
At 3 p.m. on April 30th,
mm-hmm.
we will present several very young composers who are 6 to 10 years old only, and I think
mm-hmm.
we have a couple older ones as well, who have arranged original works, have composed and arranged original works entirely
mm-hmm.
themselves with help by John Deke and a few others, for this concert. And as artistic director of Classics on Hudson, I will be performing with Mr. Deke as well. And I have done work with him before. It is spectacular what he does. This is now a worldwide organization, and we're so lucky to have him. And it's a free family concert. So we're hoping that people will come. And that's at 3 p.m. again on April 30th.
Great. So on May 7th, which is a Sunday at 5 p.m., we have Brooklyn Rider.
Brooklyn Rider are just spectacular. They are a string quartet. They are hip and happening, and they play classical music, but they also do a lot of contemporary music. On that program, they're going to do Philip Glass and Leo Sionicek, and a Beethoven quartet in F minor, the Serioso. Mm-hmm. But they're also doing a piece by Colin Jacobson, who is the violinist. He and his brother started Brooklyn Rider, as well as the Knights, K-N-I-G-H-T-N.
Mm-hmm.
And they are spectacular. They're a string quartet that stands up and plays, and they play wonderfully. They have a huge following. And I thought, this is Hudson. How about getting all of those Brooklynites who have moved to Hudson? I don't think there are any of them left in Brooklyn, but they're all up here. Let's get a Brooklyn Rider, and that's going to be very exciting.
Okay, and on May 20th, Saturday at 7 p.m., this is, I guess, Tim Thain, Roman Rabinovich, and you.
Yes, Tim Thain is an extraordinary violinist whom I knew when he was with the Rossetti Quartet some years back, and that's when I met him.
Mm-hmm.
And he is also a composer, and he's written the music to The Red Violin, among other things. And Roman Rabinovich is from Tashkent, and he's a fabulous, prodigious pianist with a prodigious memory, and he's very individual and has a great personality. And also Tim, he's so charismatic, and he can be heard on stages and screens, and his most notable soundtrack to the Academy Award-winning film Moonlight, and he did also 12 Years a Slave and Black Swan. And we're doing a program that I think is really interesting. It's Bach, and it's a group of other pieces that they will be doing, some written by Tim Thain and some that are more traditional.
Well, this is why Tammy's thrilled to have you. I can tell what you're bringing to the Hudson Hall is going to be really special and very dynamic.
Well, I hope so. I'm also very excited on June 2nd that Christopher O'Reilly of From the Top, who's my great and old and dear friend, and Matt Heimovitz, who is my great and old and dear friend, are coming to play together. And they're doing a program which is all Russian, and it is... it is their new CD that is being released.
This is Troika, the three?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's Shostakovich, Prokofiev, and Rachmaninoff. And that's going to be... And all three of these concerts will be at the Hudson Hall, which is the new, unbelievably sensational place to come and hear music. And Saturday's the big opening.
Very exciting, isn't
it? It is.
It's a great new chapter in both the town of Hudson, but certainly the hall itself.
Yes, yes.
So I have one final question. You're very accomplished. You, by any, many ways of measuring success, you are very successful. Musician, journalist, writer, parent, artistic director. What I'm wondering about at this stage of your life, you've achieved probably most things that you set out to achieve, I would assume. What do you wonder about now? Except you're here in the farmhouse, you're out of the city. What goes through your mind? What are you really thinking about? What is the personal issues that Eugenia wonders about?
You're making me all emotional. What I wonder about is how lucky I am. I do wonder about it and give thanks every day. This is the happiest time of my life, because I am married to a man who is so special and so loving and so caring of so many people. His name is Richard Novick, and he is with the New York State Broadcasters. He's been a broadcaster all his life.
Mm-hmm.
And I met him at Tanglewood, and he has a lovely small farm with animals, which I adore, too. And all of them are, of course, rescue animals.
Mm.
We have two dogs, we have two horses, and an insane feral cat. And it's beautiful up here, and it's an area that is, we call it the anti-Hamptons. because it's filled with people who, we have friends who are farmers, truck drivers, great artists, great musicians. It's a wonderful, wonderful place, and I also have a place in the city. I have a mother who's still alive at 103 on April 14. That I give thanks for all the time. My children, and especially my grandchildren, because I think having grandchildren is a very grounding experience. How lucky I am. These are two adorable, bright, funny, exciting children, and it makes me feel so happy that, you know, at this point in my life, family, I think, means more to me than anything, and my stepchildren are wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I don't in any way think that I've accomplished a lot. I don't feel that way. I feel, you know, I have a novel I'm having trouble finishing. There are difficulties of playing as you get older. You know, the flute is the only wind instrument you play without resistance. So it's all in the musculature of the face and the breathing. And I have a lot to surmount because, and I think every human does as we get older. And we also see how, you know, you're not as strong as you used to be.
Life is fragile.
Life is fragile, and yeah. Life is precious. I also feel very sad about the state of our world, as we all do. And I think there's a wonderful quote from the Talmud that says that, you know, I'm just paraphrasing, but we must not be overwhelmed by the sorrow of the world, but at the same time, we must keep, you know, moving forward and trying to make the world better. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we as individuals do it, except we voice what we want, and we watch what we don't want, and it's a real bad time right now, but I do believe we have to be hopeful. And I think what makes me the most hopeful is music, because for me, listening to music now brings something to me that it never did before. And it's hard.
Can you elaborate on that?
If I could quantify it, I don't know, but I just will hear a phrase of a Brahms piano concerto, and it makes me weep. And I don't look at that as being, you know, one of these weepy old people, but it moves me in a way that it didn't before, because it somehow, it speaks to you. It actually speaks to you in a different way, and makes you glad that you can hear it, and understand that, for me, it makes me understand that all human beings are creative. All human beings are artistic. And
well, all human beings throughout the history that we know of, we do sing, and we sing together.
And raising voices was one of the first things humans did. And howling at the moon is something we still do in a certain way.
I remember this quote from David Smith, the American sculptor, who said, well, you know, drawing came before anything else, before singing. And, you know, and I really wondered about that. You know, like, I wonder, you know, did mark making somehow come before singing? I think singing must have come first, you know, because then we must have found some way to try to communicate with each other.
Well, I think
verbally,
we were going, for a long time. Yeah, and a lot of us are still going,
Yeah. It's wonderful to think about these things, though.
It is.
So I'm getting a sense of that hope for you also is grounded in your family.
Very much so. That is what grounds me, is the family. I'm very fearful, however. And that I have to work on, because I'm fearful my grandchildren will fall down. I'm fearful someone will get sick. I'm fearful to be alone in this house. It's haunted, I'm quite sure. and now I know they're friendly ghosts. But I think...
We should let people know. You're talking about a house that was built in the early 1700s.
Yes, I am.
So it has a definite history to it.
It does.
Yes. Okay, good.
And I believe in those histories, as I do. When I know the first time I played at Carnegie Hall, I had this sense of the ghosts of the past there. Rachmaninoff was there, and all of these people. You have a sense of it. And I'm not one of those woo-woo people. But there is something about performing in a place that is imbued with the spirit of the people who made the music.
I feel that. I recently went to Paris, and, you know, you go to Delacroix studio, you go to Jackson Pollock studio, they're alive with that spirit in some manner. I think it's a question of how open are you to receiving it, rather than just denying it and looking at it just historically.
And this is one of the reasons that I fell in love with the Hudson Opera House, because 10 years ago when I got up here, I went to meet Gary Shiro, and I begged him to take me upstairs, which was, you know, dangerous and kind of falling apart. Right. And I got there and I stood there and I thought, are you kidding me? Teddy Roosevelt was
Susan
here.
B. Anthony.
Susan B. Anthony. Are you kidding me? This has to be restored.
Mm-hmm.
And the restoration is spectacular. So I would say to everyone who listens to your radio station that that is a place you have to go to and hear music, watch dance, look at all the things. It's fabulous.
Yeah, and it isn't just that, because with Tammy and Gary, they have done such a tremendous job of outreach into the community. I'm so impressed with that aspect of their programming.
Yeah.
They really do work with children. They do before and after school programs. So there's so many levels of activity going on. It really is a community center.
Well,
I think the renaming of Hudson Hall is well thought out.
Well, that's controversial, and I'm not getting into it, but I do want to mention that Classics on Hudson has a music mentors program with the Montgomery Smith Intermediate School, and that's really important to us. We have wonderful musicians from Bard College who are coming and going into the classroom and teaching, and then there it is, I think it's five times going into the classrooms, and that's very important to us too.
Well, that's a full circle, going back to you and being introduced to the flute for the first time, and had that moment not happened, who knows?
Right.
And so they're providing the same opportunity for children today in the area.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing.
It's a wonderful thing, and it's a wonderful life.
And it's a wonderful thing to get to talk with you. Thank you so much, Eugenia.
Thank you.
Such a pleasure.